from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I met with the prosecutors, and I feel like I did the right thing by doing that. And I just want them to do the right thing and get me justice for my husband. And thank you. Thank you. That's all I'm going to say. Thank you.
That was Esau Garner, the widow of Eric Garner, killed by a police chokehold this past July after police accused him of selling loose cigarettes. She spoke after the New York City medical examiner ruled that Garner's death was a homicide August 1st. Garner was taken down by six New York City police officers and held in a chokehold. A videotape of the incident made by a witness recorded him clearly and repeatedly telling police he couldn't breathe.
I can't breathe.
Late Tuesday, a New York City grand jury decided not to indict Daniel Pantaleo, the white officer accused of killing Garner, who was black, by putting him in an illegal chokehold. There are reports that NYPD was preparing for more protests stemming from the decision late Tuesday. The video showing Garner's death also showed that police waited 7 minutes before giving him cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Use of the chokehold has been prohibited by New York City police since 1993. The man who taped Garner's death, Ramsey Orta, was subsequently arrested by Garner's co-workers on the police force on weapons charges, creating a possible conflict of interest for the prosecutor, who nonetheless took the case to the grand jury without a special prosecutor. 1 week after Orta's arrest, his wife was arrested and charged with misdemeanor assault. Bernard White is program director and executive producer at CPR News and was a producer and program director at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York for decades. We spoke with him after the decision was announced. Bernard, in your decades at WBAI before you came to CPR, you saw many of these cases, including the chokehold case with Anthony Bias, a lot more. You want to talk about some of those and what you're thinking today after, and what you're feeling today after hearing that this cop is not going to be indicted either?
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. There has been just a whole host of these cases over my lifetime, you know, starting way back when I was a kid living in the projects in Manhattan. There were cases that took place back at that time. There was a cop called Gilligan who killed an unarmed person in the middle of Harlem. And there was a lot of demonstrations that took place around that. Then there was a time I was living in Queens, and there was a young 10-year-old boy named Clifford Glover who was unarmed. And he was killed by a police officer named Thomas Shea, who said that he had a gun. A gun was never found. They searched the whole area. Then, of course, Shea came back a day or so later and supposedly found the gun in the sewer. But the sewer was no place near where the young kid was murdered. And, you know, it's a 10-year-old child, and they tried to say that his father, who was 56 years old at that time, passed a gun to a 10-year-old, and that the cop had to shoot the 10-year-old because the 10-year-old pointed the gun at him. I mean, it was just an obscene scenario, but it seemed to have been bought by the jury, and Thomas Shea got off. And we've just seen so many of these trials. I maintained during the Brown indictment, as well as during this one, that these cops were going to walk, that they, you know, there was not going to be an indictment. And I think that if anyone who always picks the side that the cop is going to walk is going to have a very, very high batting average, because these cops never pay for their crimes, particularly if they take place in the black community. But I think the thing that has stuck into my mind is what really seemed to have moved a whole nation of people, a whole generation of activists, and that is the murder of Emmett Till. because there too was an unarmed young man who was beaten viciously by some white folks, and his mother had the presence of mind to let the world see what people had done, what these white men had done to her son. And I think that image was burned into the minds of many activists who came out in the 60s. This happened in 1955 America, but it took about 5 years for that struggle to really gain some momentum. And I think that this just may be, we may be in the middle of another Emmett Till type moment with the murder of Eric Garner, as well as the murder of Michael Brown, that these things coming so close. And in every community, it comes close, because in every community, every community where there are black people, there are these kinds of charges pending against police officers for using excessive force. And when these folks get off, these now celebrated cases of Garner as well as Michael Brown, it touches a nerve with them right inside their community. They can relate to it. And as a result of that, we've gotten a lot of demonstrations that have taken place across the country. Very well organized demonstrations and very well attended by a lot of different people. You see all different races involved in these demonstrations. And I think that is a very good thing. Today we find out that this guy, Daniel Pantaleo, went before a special grand jury, and they declined to indict him. And that is just going to fuel the kind of movement that has been taking place around the country. It's going to fuel it right here in New York City. I think that people are going to be outraged. One of the things that this points out, too, is that, you know, President Obama earlier this week talked about sending more money to the police department so that they can begin to buy cameras to put on police officers. Well, it wasn't the absence of cameras that was the problem.
Right. To the contrary.
Right. We see that a camera was involved in the Garner case.
And then the cameraman ended up being arrested on trumped up charges of gun possession a few days later. They were on him like white on rice.
Right, by the same police who Pantaleo worked with. So it's not the absence of cameras, it's the presence of racism and a whole culture that surrounds black men that permeates the national police departments, all police departments all over the nation, and that, you know, they've developed a culture that says that they can do whatever they want to black men, and they can get away with it. You know, there is a direct proportion of feeling good, as well as the country is feeling bad. You know, there are many people feeling bad about what the outcome of these indictments have been, or attempts to indict. But there's a joy and jubilation in the police department, because it just sends a message to them that they can continue to do whatever they want to do. I mean, when you think that Errol Garner died because he was selling a loose cigarette, I mean, that is insane. A cigarette? So it was more a cigarette was more important than the life of this individual, being out in the street selling a loose cigarette. I mean, it's insane when you see it happening. But it's a result of who is now the police chief here in New York City, Bratton, and his broken windows policies. Before that, there was the stop and frisk policy. All of these things designed to deal with black men, and they get away with it all the time.
Let me ask you on that. Let me ask you something about that, because Early on in Garner's case, like in Mike Brown's case, Eric Holder, the U.S. Attorney General, went on the record saying he was going to be watching it very closely. And we saw what the outcome of that was in Ferguson, of course. But now we see what the outcome is here as well. And this is in a city that elected Bill de Blasio, who ran as a progressive. He held out the fact that his son is black and would be subject to stop and frisk. He ran against stop and frisk at the very end and was elected, many people say, as a consequence of that. And yet, behind the scenes, obviously something's going on where Bratton and de Blasio know that it's okay for this outcome in terms of what Holder might do next. So where exactly do you go to try to solve this problem?
Well, I think that there's several layers to it. One of them is the Police Benevolent Association. This Police Benevolent Association here in New York City, which is the union for the cops, has become a very, very powerful political tool for the police. They, they participate in elections. They have a lot of power. They can apply pressure not only here locally, but also nationally, because they have counterparts all over the country. When you think that the Fraternal Order of Police in Philadelphia
right.
is probably the primary reason why Mumia is still in jail.
That's right.
So, you know, that's a testimony to the kind of power that they have. So one thing is begin to dismantle some of this power that these police organizations have. The other thing is that people have to get back into the street, and they have to begin to make demands and then begin to fashion a strategy to ensure that those demands are met. Then that's one of the things that's disheartening about these young people that are out there now. When you begin to see signs saying, instead of no justice, no peace, which to me doesn't mean anything, when they start saying no justice, no profit, I think that they are cutting, they have zeroed in on what this the whole justice or lack of justice thing is all about. Then they have to begin to stop the profit, these corporations' ability to acquire profits that is going to help to stop this thing. That seems to be what gets the attention of folks. And then the black community itself has to make a determination that they're just not going to allow this to happen anymore. And I don't know exactly how they are going to make that known, but they have to make it known that they're not going to stand for it. I don't think that there's any other community in this country that has been under attack like the black community has, and has not responded. The black community has got to respond to this in an organized way to bring it about. One of the shortcomings that we have in the black community is black politicians who seem to be afraid to deal with this issue. This is not a new issue. They should have been screaming about this for years, but they have become very quiet on this issue. So it's about also dealing with the political process. So there has to be a multi-pronged strategy to deal with this. It's a very serious problem.
You know, you mentioned, in fact, we spoke about it a week or two ago as well, about Emmett Till being one of the motivators of you coming to consciousness. And you were young at that point, like 5 or 6 yourself, right?
So, I was about 9.
Yeah. Okay, so you're older than I thought. But a decade later, you had uprisings in cities across the country, in Newark and Detroit and in New York and in Los Angeles and many other places. And there was a, you know, this happened simultaneously with the rise of the, not as a consequence, but simultaneously with the rise of the Black Panthers and the idea of self-defense against police violence. The response of the system at that time was to essentially decapitate that movement, and things actually ended up getting worse after the fact. What do you think, what lessons do you think we can draw from that here?
Well, I think that that the Black community certainly needs to be able to defend itself, that it is in fact under attack, and these murders are an indication of the level of attack, and that I think that that there has to be some consequences to these actions. Right now, there are no consequences. You go through the court system, and there are no consequences at the end of that journey. There has to be some way to bring about consequences to these people who are murdering and beating Black people. And I think that the community will figure out a way to make sure that there are consequences, because in the absence of consequences, these will continue.
And then you mentioned how, for example, in Ferguson, here in New York, the protests, also the solidarity protests, and elsewhere in the country, are multiracial, that there are lots of young people. And you can see some of the faces and some of the names of people that are, you know, brought into the media are some of the same people that were involved in the Occupy movement, for example. Now, back in the 60s, there was sort of a coalescing that had begun between the anti-war movement, which was largely a white middle-class phenomenon, and the struggle for Black liberation. And that was essentially shut down by eliminating the draft. This time, the kids, you know, the young, formerly middle-class white kids that constituted in the main the Occupy movement, their condition can't be legislated away, and in fact is going to only intensify. Do you think that speaks to the possibility of a more enduring coalition?
I think so, and I think so for other reasons too. I think that these young folks have grown up in a generation that has been different than ours. They pretty much have their own way of communicating. Our primary way of communicating was, or getting communications, was through television, which was highly regulated, highly restricted. They have their own way, own avenues of communication. They can call a demonstration within a couple of minutes. And I was watching TV the other day, and there was a woman who was at a free concert on 42nd Street. And how she found out about it was that her husband, who was a minor in Australia, was reading something and saw that there was a free concert going to be on 42nd Street. He texted her here in New York City, because she was here vacationing with her friends, and she wound up coming to the concert. That represents a rapidity of exchanging information that we aren't familiar with. You know, our generation is not as familiar with it as these young people. So they have a way of communicating very quickly and reaching a large number of people. And I think that their demonstrations and their ability to organize around the country, because my friend Suzanne Ross, or our friend Suzanne Ross, right, has pointed out that there are more cities where there are demonstrations in the aftermath of the Mike Brown decision than there were in the aftermath of the King assassination. Mm. And I think that that's significant.
Yeah, I think you're right. That probably is a consequence of the communications that are available. Okay, anything else you want to add?
Well, that I think that we very well may be in a special moment right here. because people have been sensitized to the fact that no matter what the evidence suggests or what the evidence says, that white police officers can get away with killing black men, no matter what the circumstances are, and that this is going to outrage a number of people, who, and especially a number of young white folks, who now have black heroes, which is something that didn't exist when we were young. And they recognize that these are human beings. And hopefully they'll continue to be out there and struggle and bring about the kind of social change that they think needs to happen.
A member of the U.S. military in charge of a ready-to-launch nuclear missile is accused of using psychoactive drugs like ecstasy and covering it up. We have this report from Press TV.
A U.S. officer in charge of a ready-to-launch nuclear missile has been charged with abuse of psychoactive drugs and obstruction of justice. Nicole Dalmazzi will be court-martialed on January the 21st. Dalmazzi is the first launch officer to be charged as part of a drug abuse inquiry by the U.S. Air Force. She's accused of using drugs such as ecstasy and trying to hide it by deceiving investigators. Dalmazzi has been a nuclear missile launch officer at Malmstrom Air Force Base. The base in the state of Montana operates 150 U.S. nukes. Two other missile launch officers at the base are also being investigated for drug abuse. The probe was made public in January after embarrassing revelations of low morale and disciplinary issues among U.S. nuclear missile personnel.
As we reported yesterday, there's been a surprise shakeup in the Israeli government. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Tuesday he was firing his cabinet and called for new elections. The elections are scheduled for March of next year. That move came after days of intense political infighting between Netanyahu and his coalition partners. Meanwhile, Israel took another hit at the UN Tuesday, this time at the General Assembly. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe has more.
The United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly approves a resolution taking a swipe at Israel. The resolution asks Tel Aviv to become a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, commonly known as NPT. It also calls on Israel to put its nuclear facilities under the safeguard of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The resolution was passed by 161 yes votes. Apart from Israel, the U.S. and Canada were among the countries that voted against the measure. 18 countries also abstained. Israel is known as the only possessor of the nuclear weapons in the Middle East. However, Tel Aviv neither denies nor confirms possessing nuclear weapons.
Three of the leaders of recent protests in Hong Kong surrendered to authorities Tuesday, but apparently no one was interested. We have this report from the Chinese news agency CCTV.
Three co-founders of the Occupy Central movement surrendered to police in Hong Kong this afternoon, but were released without charge. They admitted that they had participated in gatherings in occupied areas and that the action may constitute a crime. They were greeted by anti-Occupy people who chanted and accused the Occupy leaders of dividing society and damaging people's lives. Rimsky-Yuan, Secretary for Justice in Hong Kong, reiterated that the whole Occupy movement is illegal and has severely affected the social order. He said the Hong Kong SAR government will take timely action and deal with the illegal protesters lawfully. The Occupy Central protests in Hong Kong's busiest areas since September the 28th have caused serious traffic disruption, temporary closure of schools, banks, government headquarters, and several clashes.
On Tuesday, 50 years to the day that the free speech movement peaked with hundreds of arrests at the University of California at Berkeley, students occupied the University Plaza again, this time to protest tuition hikes. A group calling itself the Open University hosted a rally there Tuesday afternoon, 50 years to the day after student leader Mario Savio gave a famous speech protesting a ban on political activity. We close with Savio's words from December 2nd, 1964.
You know, I just want to say one brief thing about something the previous speaker said. I didn't want to spend too much time on that because I don't think it's important enough, but one thing is worth considering. He's the nominal head of an organization supposedly representative of the undergraduates, whereas in fact, under the Kerr directives, it derives its authority as delegated power from the administration. It's totally unrepresentative of the graduate students and TAs. But he made the following statement, I quote, I would ask all those who are not definitely committed to the FSM cause to stay away from the demonstration. All right, now listen to this. For all upper division students who are interested in alleviating the TA shortage problem, I would encourage you to offer your services to department chairmen and advisors. That has two things, a strike breaker and a fink. I'd like to say, one other thing about a union problem. Upstairs, you may have noticed already on the second floor of Sproul Hall, locals 40 and 127 of the Painters Union are painting the inside of the second floor of Sproul Hall. Now, apparently that action had been planned sometime in the past. I've tried to contact those unions, unfortunately, and tears my heart out, they're as bureaucratized as the administration. It's difficult to get through to anyone in authority there. Very sad. We're still making an attempt. Those people up there have no desire to interfere with what we're doing. I would ask that they be considered and that they not be heckled in any way. And I think that, you know, while there's unfortunately no sense of solidarity at this point between unions and students, there at least need be no, you know, excessively hard feelings between the two groups. Now, there are at least two ways in which sit-ins and civil disobedience and whatever, at least two major ways in which it can occur. One, when a law exists, is promulgated, which is totally unacceptable to people, and they violate it again and again and again till it's rescinded, appealed. All right, but there's another way. Sometimes the form of the law is such as to render impossible its effective violation as a method to have it repealed. Sometimes the grievances of people extend to a whole mode of arbitrary power, a whole mode of arbitrary exercise of arbitrary power. And that's what we have here. We have an autocracy which runs this university. It's managed. We were told the following. If President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider. If this is a firm, and if the Board of Regents are the Board of Directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, then I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials. But we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. We're human beings. And that brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.